Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Have you figured your taxes yet? I haven't done mine. Although I've done some organizing. I have all the papers organized and ready to go. So I've made some progress there. And even then, oftentimes questions come up about what I do have, and my wife and I have sometimes serious discussions about the whole process. I don't know what you do, but it can be a headache. Dale Kunin, though, can help us. She's a certified public accountant, certified information technology professional. She holds an MS in accounting science from UW-Madison. And you know what? She's got over 20 years' experience as an accounting professional. Working in public accounting, she works in private industry, government, education. She's a partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison. So great to have her back. And certainly if you have questions about your taxes, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. Dale Kunin, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, great to have you back. Busy at this time of the year, I assume.
Yes, but we love it. We look forward to this time of year.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of exciting in some ways.
Yeah. It's a little harder because the weather's been great, so we prefer when the weather's not good.
I understand. Well, we had already an email from Tom in Wanakee, who in 2011 rolled his IRAs over. And funds from his Wisconsin deferred compensation account to one IRA, and has received Form 1099-R from each of those closed, rolled over accounts. How does he report that those rolled over IRAs, and not taking the distribution as 2011 income?
It's very simple. If you're doing it by hand. On line 16 of your return is where you put distributions from pensions. And there's an A and a B on that line. Yep. And the A is what's on the 1099-R. And then on the B is zero because none of it's taxable. So you identify the amount that's on the 1099 and then the amount, if any, that's taxable. And that's all
that's
you have to
all
do.
You have to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it.
Simple enough. Helen in West Salem has a question for you. Hi, Helen.
Hi. My question is about what I have to save. Now, with our contributions, of which we have a lot, I list the check number and the date it was sent. But then we get all these thank you notes back from people. So my question is, do I need to save those thank you notes? As long as I have the check number and the date listed.
The answer to that is yes, because not only are those thank you notes, they're what's referred to as substantiation acknowledgments that prove that what you...
The check you wrote.
The check you wrote was either 100% tax deductible, or sometimes it'll say on there, 20% of it was for a meal or something.
Yeah.
So the IRS...
Well, I always indicate that if it's like 40% or 20% too. I indicate that if it isn't 100%.
Right. Possible. Well, it sounds like you're very organized, but the IRS does require you to have those substantiation receipts. So if you would get audited or asked, they would want to see those.
You know what? I like to keep them because the address... is of the place is on, and typically you have to include the address of where you made the donation on the request, and the address is always on the thank you. So that's one good reason to keep the thank you.
But then how many years should you keep all this?
Well, that's a good question. We typically tell people to keep it for 7 years. The tax year gets closed after 3 years after you file. But there are circumstances under which they can open it. But typically an audit the year's closed three years after you file. So you're going to file your 2011 and 2012. So if you file it by April 17th this year, then it's 3 years from then when that year would be closed. But if there were... issues that were fraud or something that they could open it for, we recommend you keep it 7 years.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And is there a certain amount that where you have to really be careful about this? I mean, let's say if you only donated $100 or something for the year, or maybe you donated a couple of $1,000 for the year, would there be an amount that you'd have to worry?
Well, the answer is, of course, it depends. The IRS computers have some algorithm which they don't share with us. What the average charitable donation is for someone at a specific income level.
Yeah.
And theoretically, if you're above that, then it might be flagged. But we don't know what that is. And, of course, if you have legitimate charitable deductions, then you should take them. Where they may, where you need to be concerned about a limit is for non-cash charitable contributions, the stuff you take to Goodwill or those. You need to file an extra form for non-cash charitable contributions that are more than $500 in total. And a lot of people don't realize that, and so that could be a flag. So if you the extra form that you file has who you donated to, the address, as Larry was saying, the amount and a description of what you donated. And so if you report $1,000 of non-cash charitable contributions and don't have that form, then they're going to notice.
They're gonna notice it. And I know the other thing, nonprofits, Judith reminds me, has worked a lot with nonprofits over the years. They are not required to give letters for under $250. So thank you. They're not required. Some do anyway, of course. But so you need to keep your own records just to make sure that, you know, it's all on the up and up. George in Madison, your turn. Hi, George.
Hi there. I have a question about starting a part-time business. And my question is, if I purchased something in 2011 for the business, but I haven't started the business yet, can I still deduct that, or how does that work?
Well, it's considered a startup cost, and there has to be a date by which you determine that you have started in business, and you can accumulate all those expenses that you had prior to actually your first day of being open or holding yourself out as available to provide a service, if it's a service-based business. And there is a provision to, used to be you had to capitalize that, you couldn't deduct it all at once. You had to take a part of that expense each year for 15 years. But the rules now are that you can take most of it in that first year, but you can't take the deduction until you've actually started business. So if you didn't start until 2012, you need to save up those receipts, and you need to characterize them as startup costs when you do expense them.
There you go. Thanks, George. Appreciate your call. Gus in Green Bay, hello to you.
Yes, good morning, Larry.
Morning.
I got a question about residential energy credit. I had a new roof, new shingles put on my primary residence, plus insulation in the attic. It cost a bundle of money. Now I'm wondering, do I get any credit for that?
The residential energy credit had a lifetime limit of taking $1,500, and that is not available in 2011. The energy credits for there's some special ones that are still available, like if you have solar powered energy or geothermal energy, but the insulation is not, and the roof. There was, like, if it was a copper roof or something like that, but just a regular shingled roof was never qualified for the energy credits.
So you're kind of out of luck, unfortunately. Gus, sorry we couldn't help you out there. Thanks for calling. Mary in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Nice to be on your show.
Thank you.
I have a sole proprietorship, LLC, and I use it mainly for tax deductions now. I have not sold anything in about 4 years through that. Now, I feel guilty about it, and should I? I mean, is that a bad thing to do? Should I not be doing that?
So you're saying that you have a sole proprietorship that is not profitable. You don't have any income.
Right, but I use it because we travel and we should, you know, we do an import business and we get artifacts and then we sell them. That's the idea.
And but are you saying that you haven't had any income or that it's been a loss?
It's been minimal income to none sometimes.
So some years. So the issue then is the IRS would raise is whether this is a hobby or an actual business. And there's kind of facts and circumstances for the cases of whether it's a hobby or a business. And so hobby losses are limited to the income on the hobby for that year. There's some analysis if you are in it for profit motive or you're in it so that you can travel and deduct your expenses.
Yeah.
That would be a case against it being a true business. Whether you operate and function as an actual business, you advertise, you keep books of the business and have a business plan and all these kind of checklist items, you could continue to report it as if it was a business, but you go a few years and the IRS may decide that it's a hobby. And you report a hobby, you can deduct expenses, but you can't deduct more expenses than you had income. You can just zero it out.
Okay. Mm.
And isn't it, if you lose money, isn't it 3 years in a row or something, you're going to...
Well, it's really the other side that if you have, in fact, made money 3 years out of five, then that's a case for it being a business.
Right,
that's
okay.
Not to say that if you lose 3 years in a row that you're automatically not a business.
Okay. All right. There we go. Thanks, Mary. Thanks very much for calling. Dale Kunin, our guest today, she is a certified public accountant and a partner with Wagner CPAs in Madison, talking your taxes and mine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Judith Sears-Poisson, our very articulate producer, answering the phones and talking with you before you get on the air. Talking taxes with Dale Kunin. Dale, we have an email from Stuart in Madison who says, I converted a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA in March of 2011. As I prepare my 2011 tax return, I recall a 2010 ruling allowing taxes on interest earned on traditional IRAs in this type of conversion could be spread over 2 to 3 years, and that was extended into 2011. Do you know if that is correct?
There was an allowance that if you converted your traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you last year you could pay the taxes on it in this year and next year. It wasn't just for the interest. It was for it was for the IRA. The traditional IRA had never been taxed. So when you take it out, it's all subject to tax.
Okay.
And so it's not the interest. And I do want to respond to additional information for the gentleman that asked about his installation.
Yeah.
There is still a credit for installation if he's insulation on his primary residence. And the roof has to have been one of those metal roofs or... If it was an asphalt roof that had certain coatings that made it Energy Star, then there is still a credit available for that. So I wanted to clarify that.
All right. What do you have for tips for claiming a home office deduction for depreciation of office space in the home? What are the ways of going about it? And Are there drawbacks to be aware of in a situation like that?
Yes. First of all, to claim the opportunity to claim a home office deduction allows you to take what portion of the house you use exclusively for that business, meaning that you don't use it as a guest room or as a TV room. It's the only space for the business, and it's used exclusively for the business. And if you qualify, you can deduct a percentage of your real estate taxes and your mortgage interest, your utilities, your phone bills, sometimes, and insurance costs. But so if you're using that, the kids' playroom or something like that, it's not going to qualify. And you shouldn't be afraid to take it if it's legitimate. The cautionary tale on that is that for instance, your mortgage interest and your real estate tax are also deductible on your Schedule A. But if you deduct them on your home office, you're going to reduce your self-employment taxes as well. So, but taking the depreciation involves recapturing it when you sell the house. So you will have to pay, you may have to pay a little more taxes at the time that you sell the house. So I tell people who are in their home and they're not planning to sell it in 2 years that they should go ahead and take it if it's legitimate.
All right. On to Ryan in La Crosse now. Ryan, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A friend of mine and I, we started a company. We make humidity-controlled display cases for guitars and stringed instruments. And so they're a little bit, you know, they retail between like $700 and $1,100. And what we want to do is give some away, excuse me, to people that are sort of influential, I guess, in the music industry. But I'm wondering how that affects my taxable income. Do I get to deduct the full retail value of it because if we would have sold it at retail, that's what we would have brought in. So is it like a loss? Or do we, you know, only get to deduct the cost that it that went into building the case?
If you are tracking the cost of building the case through your inventory system, then you take an inventory count at the end of the year, and that item is no longer in your inventory, and so there's an adjustment made for the reducing your inventory and increasing your cost of sales by that amount. So what that means is, yes, you can only deduct the cost of that item. And if you sell to the end user, you have sales tax issues. And so if you give away an item, you still have to report some sales tax on that if you haven't paid sales tax on the items that you bought.
I suppose, though, you could, let's say something like that. Maybe it's heavy, maybe it costs a delivery. Any costs that you might incur in terms of contacting the people, in terms of delivering, those are all legitimate expenses to knock off.
Right.
It's just part of marketing.
Right.
So can I just ask for one quick clarification? If
sure.
I don't sell it, you're saying I have to go back and pay the sales tax on the supplies if I'm giving it away?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for the help.
Yep, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Ryan. Appreciate it. And, my goodness, here's Stacy in Peshtigo with a question. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, my husband buys and sells a lot of items, you know, some lower, you know, mostly lower cost things on eBay, and uses PayPal for those purchases and also for his, you know, sales transactions. Should he be paying taxes on those things or, you know, keeping track of them so that that is noted every year?
And what is he selling?
Well, just various things like musical instrument stuff, shoes.
Are they used or new?
This is all used stuff.
Okay. So are you asking if he has to pay income tax on it?
Should he be paying sales tax?
Sales tax. If they're used and you're selling them over the internet and delivering them to other places, no, you do not have to.
Okay. So when does an individual have to pay taxes on items that they sell via eBay or purchases that they make?
Well, purchases is based on who's charging you. And in absence of a so if you're in Wisconsin and mm-hmm. you buy something from somebody who's in Wisconsin and they deliver to you in Wisconsin and it's a new item, then there should have been and they're selling it to you to make money, then there could be sales tax on that. Now the person selling it has to have, they may be just doing this and their volume doesn't rise to the point of having to pay sales tax or collect sales tax mm-hmm. because it's a part-time kind of thing and it's they don't do it every day. There's specific rules with sales tax on when you become when you need a seller's permit and you need to start collecting sales tax.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Jonas received a Schedule K for attorney's fees for the attorney who handled the father's law estate, father-in-law's estate, excuse me, father-in-law's estate. How do you think that will affect the return for Jonah this year? So he got a Schedule K for attorney's fees for the attorney who handled the father-in-law's estate. I don't think there's anything, is there?
No, the Schedule K is for payments that were made by credit card to vendors and service providers in the course of business. It's like a 1099. It was new this year that the credit card and PayPal people have to send out those 1099. So I'm not sure why he got a 1099 for the fees. If he paid the attorney with a credit card, then that's why he would
have gotten it.
And if those were paid by the estate, then it's going to be an expense for the estate, not on his tax return.
Fred in Eau Claire, turning to you now. Hi, Fred.
Hello. I have a question for a relative who just this last year, for the first time, acted as a union negotiator and received a sum of money above and beyond the normally contracted wage for their work. And that income was not reported on the W-2. It was reported on a 1099 form. I'm curious how that needs to be reported for taxes in 2011. Is it part of the wages that would occur just in a normal 1040, or does it need to be reported as something like self-employment income on a separate form?
He received a 1099 from the same employer who pays him his wages?
Correct.
That's unusual, but a 1099 needs to be reported if it was reported as miscellaneous non-employee compensation, then it is subject to self-employment taxes and would go
Schedule SE or
right, a Schedule SE, and depending if he has any expenses to deduct against it, he would put it on a Schedule C. If he doesn't, he could just put it on the front page of the 1040 and then also on the Schedule SE.
Okay. Is there a way, you mentioned a specific kind of miscellaneous income. Is there a way to determine how it was reported by that form?
Yes, box it's reported in. There on the 1099 miscellaneous, there is a line for rent. There's a line for attorney's fees. There's a line for non-employee compensation, for other, for gifts and prizes. So what box it was in. If it's in other, there may be an option to not report it as SE income, but if it's on the non-employee compensation line, then it's definitely subject to self-employment tax.
It's kind of weird, though, isn't it? Because he's already an employee.
Yes.
That's really strange.
Yes.
You might want to ask why he got that reported that way. Could have been a mistake on their part, too, for that matter.
Could be.
Good luck, Fred. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Russell in Rio. Thank you for calling. Hello.
We have a seasonal rental cabin that's only open about 3 months of the year, and we were told that there's a 500-hour rule that the owner needs to put in at least 500 hours of labor a year in order to become a non-passive investment. Is this right? I mean, 500 hours would be about 3 months of 8-hour days, and the thing isn't open only 3 months.
Is it your is it a second home or it's only a rental?
We used to stay there, but we needed to make some money on it, so it could be a second home, I suppose, if we wanted to.
The hour rule is is really about whether you're actually a real estate professional, and I don't think that you are. So it really is a rental property. There's nothing else about it except do you own any other rental property?
No.
So
what is it, Schedule E or something?
It's a Schedule E, and it also the amount of what you can deduct is based on how much time you stayed in it during the year versus how much it was held out for rental. So there are limits on the deductions available. If you say it's available for rental 3 months of the year and you stayed in it 6 months, I'm not saying that you did, then it doesn't you don't get the same deductions. It's a second home.
Yeah. It's only seasonal, so, I mean, the water's, you know, turned off for the winter. And
Yep.
It's rental property.
Yep. Schedule E.
That's right.
Thanks, Russ, for calling. Appreciate it. Larry in Green Bay. Hello to you.
Hello. I have a question on a rental also. It's a single-family home, and I've had been renting it for about 5 years, but I have never taken a depreciation deduction, and I'm wondering how I go about starting that.
So you own the home and it's rented out?
Yes.
And you don't live in it?
Nope.
Well, you for a residential rental property, you get about 30 years of depreciation on the value on your cost at the of the building, not the land. So you'd have to look at your assessment and figure out what percentage is the land and what percentage is the building. And then how long did you say you had been renting it out?
I've been renting it probably 5 years or so, but I've owned it about 10. And I have never taken a depreciation deduction.
Well, you could go back and a couple things. You could go back and amend up to 3 years. You've passed the ability to take advantage of the depreciation for the first 2 years. Have you been able to? Have you had a loss or have you had income on the rental?
I've had income on it.
So the depreciation deduction would be valuable. So
yes.
You would have to start from the point of when you started renting it out, so 5 years ago, and you lost that depreciation. So you start in the year that you can go back to and take the depreciation. So if it was a $30,000 building, then you get about $1,000 a year to add to the expenses and depreciate it.
I would go back to the beginning of the rental.
If you wanted to do that, you would have to amend prior returns. You could start this year and depreciate what would be the sixth year of
okay.
the depreciation. But if you want to get that third, fourth, and fifth year, you'd have to go back and amend.
Got it. Now, is there a depreciation form or schedule that I use?
Yes, there is. It's a 4562, and it is there's instructions for it, or you can most people, when they get involved with depreciation and real estate rental, usually seek outside assistance for preparing their return. But it's and a Form 4562, and that's what you'd have to fill out.
How do I establish the value of it at the beginning?
Well, it's really your cost. You can't depreciate more than what you paid for it. So if you bought it 10 years ago, you know what you paid for it. Were there any improvements? And you have to go with what you paid for it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Joe in Franklin with a question for you. Dale? Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm getting all my tax stuff together here, and I've had considerable medical expenses last year. One of the big ones was dental implants. Now, are those deductible?
Under the medical deduction, probably, I would think. But
I believe they are if they if it wasn't considered cosmetic surgery. I believe they are. Let me just see if I can find.
Can't imagine those would be considered cosmetic, but.
Well.
Maybe.
It depends.
I needed them to eat, so.
Yeah.
And the medical expenses, though, are limited. You have to have, you can only deduct the amount that exceeds 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So,
I don't know that, so.
If that'll help you get up there, then yes.
Oh, definitely. It would definitely would. So they are, you can include them in medical deductions?
I believe you can.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe. Thank you for calling. We have Ned in Wausau next with a question for you or comment. Hi, Ned.
Hi. I was wondering, within about 5 years or less, I'll be retiring probably, and I was wondering, as a professor in the UW system, can we, if we only teach through the end of May, and that's the end of the academic year, and then we retire, in that last 5 months or so of our employment, is it possible for us to donate up to the maximum of $6,000 a year towards a Roth IRA, even if that includes the vast majority of my income over those months?
You're asking if you can make a Roth contribution.
For the whole year.
Yes.
The last year that I work, even though I only work for 5 months out of 12.
Yeah, the rule is that you have to have earned income equal to or more than the amount of the Roth investment
right.
or contribution.
So you're good.
So if you earned $6,000 in the first month and you didn't work the rest of the year, you could put it all into a Roth.
I see how it works.
Yes.
Okay.
There you go.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. And Bob in Menasha, hello to you.
Hello. My question regarding a 8606 form, what we did was rolled over two 403Bs into an existing IRA,
mm-hmm.
and then also there was a withdrawal taken out of that IRA. Now, I guess the 8606, what I put down for my basis in line two, the last basis we had was back in 2005.
The 8606 is used to track non-deductible IRAs. That's what the basis is about, and recharacterizations when people go back and forth between a Roth and a traditional IRA, which is one of the new kind of tax planning options available, since you can convert from your traditional to a Roth IRA now, and then you have until next year to unconvert it if the balance in the account goes way down. so that you wouldn't have to pay the taxes. So the basis in your IRA is what you've paid taxes on, what the amounts that you've actually
withdrawn.
Not withdrawn, but the amount that constitutes after tax money in the IRA. So if you were taking money out, if it had been subject to tax already, like in a Roth IRA, then you don't have to pay taxes on that. Or
right.
I don't see them so much anymore, but it used to be people made non-deductible contributions to their IRA, meaning they didn't qualify for the deductible contribution, but they were able to put money in and the earnings would grow tax-free. And so then they had to separate out how much they put in that was already taxed from how much was growing as the years went on. And so that's where the basis started from, and then people with Roth IRAs. So it wasn't meant to report how much the value of your IRA is right now.
Well, then, I mean, like, for instance, well, just ballpark figures, our basis was back in 2005 was $9,100 because of previous years where we made non-deductible contributions.
Okay.
And then that figure goes on line two, but then I come up with line six, which says enter the value of all your traditional SEP and simple IRAs. That figure presently comes up to about ballpark figure $75,000.
Uh-huh.
So is that what I put in that line, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Because they're trying to determine what I said, what the 9,000 that you put in there, 9,100, you already paid taxes on. So if you take money out, they're going to say that a percentage of it is subject to tax, and a percentage of it is not subject to tax.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dale Kunin, our guest today. She's a certified public accountant and certified information technology professional with Wegner CPAs in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a tax question, I hope you'll join in as we visit with Dale Kunin from Wegner CPAs in Madison. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Open line. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. Ron in Sheboygan, you are up next. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I have a son that's in college, and he has an ROTC scholarship. Now, do I have to put that down as earnings for him, or how do I record that?
If it's an actual scholarship that's paid directly, that he doesn't actually get the money, it goes to the school.
Correct. It goes to the school for tuition. He has full tuition, but he has to do his duty after he's out of college.
Right. So you don't have to, whatever paperwork they send, I don't believe that they'll send a W-2 because he's not really working. He does not have to include that in his income. On the tuition notice form that is sent out, there is a line for scholarships, and that's usually included there, and then it affects how much you can deduct for a tuition credit. So you can't deduct amounts that were paid by scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main effect that it would have.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you, Ron. And Greg in Mineral Point, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two quick questions. We have a couple of one kid that we send to daycare. So it's a 2441 form, I believe it is. And was wondering if there's is there a minimum amount that needs to be spent on a second child? We want to bump them up to that $6,000 limit, and with the one child, we paid slightly over $3,000, but we want to get the full benefit of the $6,000. And the second child, it was just kind of by chance that we ended up sending them to daycare for a couple of days. So I was wondering if there is a minimum amount that needs to be spent on that second child to be eligible for the $6,000, or if it's just
you have.
You know,
I'm sorry, hi. You have to report on that form the total amount you paid to each child care provider.
Right.
By child.
Okay.
So if you spent $7,000 for one kid and $5 for another kid, you don't get $6,000. It's
you get $3,000.
Yeah.
The one child was over the $3,000 amount,
mm-hmm.
and then the other child was, you know, say under $100. So I cannot use the $6,000 total.
No, because you have to report on
per
the
child.
Form.
Right.
By child.
Okay.
And so that's
how it works.
Okay. And the other question was just some incidental income. It's that my wife received, and we're not going to get a 1099 because it's below $600. And I'm sure if we went through and did all the due diligence, it probably would have been a loss as far as the expenses that go out and the revenue coming in. So what form, I've been looking on the internet, they talk about a C or a CEZ, or there's some publication 535. What's the, if it's under 600 and it would probably net to a loss, again, it's the purpose of it is not to make money. It's just incidental through a product that we've purchased. And then there are some small sales to some other people along with that product, but it's well under the $600 limit, won't get a 1099. What would be the process for going through that? If any.
Well, the fact that the 1099s are only required to be issued if it's 600 or more doesn't mean that you don't have to report income that is less than that. And
right.
I have clients who choose to issue 1099s to business clients who choose to issue them to everybody. And one of my partners compared that to the person who's driving in the left lane 65 miles an hour and is not going to let anybody pass them or go over the speed limit. They're going to make sure that those dollars are reported for income.
Right.
So
okay.
You can do a schedule CEZ. You can also report it on the other income line on your 1040, and then report on the face of it also the expenses. So I think what you're saying is that you had, say, $400 and you had $500 of expenses.
Correct.
So then we're back to whether this was a hobby or a business. And if it was a hobby, then you're supposed to report the income and then you limit the loss to the income and you end up with zero. Which is better than not reporting it at all.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you very much for calling. Jim in Bayfield County, we turn to you now. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Let's see. About 2 years ago, wanting to take advantage of the first-time homeowner credit, the $8,000
sure.
credit, I bought a home. Because of time limits, I bought a home that I like, but I've now found one that I like better. If I buy this second home, do I have to return that $8,000 to Uncle Sam?
And when did you buy
yep.
this?
Just 2 years ago, just before the end of the. I was pushed to buy it, so I did.
Yes, there is a payback that is required. It's prorated for how long you've lived in it.
Oh, it is prorated.
Yes. Offhand, I don't know what the percentages are, but upon the sale of the home, if you haven't gone through the whole period of time, then you do have to put that on your tax return.
Hmm.
How long is the time? Do you know?
I don't know, but I can look it up. I just don't
Stay
remember.
Stay listening.
Up.
We'll see. Maybe over offhand. Our news break we can look
okay.
it up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Yeah, I'm sure it's more than 2 years.
It is.
Yeah, for sure. Mark in Wausau. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm retired, and I do have a job. And we used to get a credit called Making Income Count, I think it was called, on our federal tax.
You're talking about the Making Work Credit?
Making
work,
work
Pay
yes.
Credit?
Yes.
That
yes,
has expired.
Okay.
That's not available in 2011.
Okay, is there any chance that might come back when they reinstate the, you know, the payroll tax cut or something? I thought it might be in that package.
I cannot predict what Congress will do, but that's not one that was, like, on the table. It was what they did is they replaced it with this payroll tax cut, you know, the reduction of what you have to pay in on your Social Security taxes. And so for that reason, I don't think it's coming back.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. We have an email from Patrick, a grad student with a simple situation, has a W-2 from his financial stipend and his 1098 for tuition payments. What's the easiest, most cost-effective way for me to prepare my taxes? I can't imagine this is a situation where I would necessarily need the second look from another provider.
I think you're asking, what advantages can I get? You have your W-2, which I don't know how much that is, and you have the option for a tuition tax credit, and you're going to want to try to maximize that. And depending on what your income is, there's also a Wisconsin deduction for tuition. So if you follow the steps and instructions in the book, as a grad student, you aren't eligible for, there's abundant different credits, and sometimes you have to choose which is the maximum one, but you would only be eligible for the lifetime learning credit. So I think it is fairly simple. Just make sure that if you, on your 1098 for the tuition payments, if there is an amount that was subsidized or, you know, not paid, there was scholarship, that you can't take that credit for those dollars.
There we go. When do we need a provider, tax preparer, somebody to help?
Typically, people who've been doing their own taxes step up to a tax preparer when they buy a house and they are concerned about the itemized deductions. We have situations where there are domestic partners living together who need assistance on how they can structure their taxes. Then the other, if there's a business involved on the 1040 or rental property, there are some of our taxpayers, our clients, who have complicated investments, and they need assistance with getting all of that reported correctly. Like anything, there are things you could do yourself, and there are things that I don't paint my house anymore. I did when I was young, but now now I pay somebody to do it much more efficiently than I could. But when things get complicated, somebody who simply has a W-2 and maybe some interest or student loan, really they can do their return themselves.
John in La Crosse, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm just wondering how many years do we have to keep our state and federal returns on file, you know, in case of an audit or whatever? It's not a business, just just personal.
We usually say 7 years.
Seven? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Well, it is kind of fun to look back, although now I've gotten rid of some of my taxes forms from years back, but to look back through some of those old forms is really quite
eye-opening.
Yeah, eye-opening and almost hilarious in some ways.
Some people like to keep lots of things, and with electronic storage now, you could scan them and keep them if you wanted to, but as I mentioned before, the tax years stay open for 3 years, so you definitely need the records for that. And then going back 7 years is if there's issues that are not just audits that are random audits, but if there was some issue of fraud or
you could be in trouble if you do that. And now You mentioned just in passing that the deadline for filing was April 17th, and, you know, it's normally the 15th.
Yes. In fact, this year, the 15th is on Sunday, and the filing deadline is never on a non-business day.
Yeah.
And then the 16th is a holiday in the District of Columbia. I think it's Patriots Day, but I might have it mistaken with something else. And so there, the District of Columbia rules say that when it falls on that's a tax holiday. And so it's April 17th, and most of the states are following through. Last year also, it was not the 15th. So it is an extension of the time to get it filed. We see most people who are last minute people, doesn't matter if it's the 15th or the 17th.
That's right. We'll be back with Dale Cuden in just a couple of minutes. Talking about your tax preparation today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dale Cuden, certified public accountant and a partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison. Great to have her back, and thank you so much for listening in. If you have a question, you can call. The lines are all filled now, but here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or just email us at talk@wpr.org. Barb in Crystal Lake, Illinois, has a question for you, Dale, so let's go to Barb. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I'm wondering, last year in 2011, I became my mother's guardian for her estate and her person, and I need a record-keeping method to know what federal expenses I'm going to be able to deduct and nursing home expenses, and I need a plan.
Is this... Are you talking about for filing your mother's return?
Yes.
So, if her return, if you have the power of attorney to sign for her, then you would report her income if she has Social Security or pension, and if she's in a nursing home, they will give you a. Substantiation letter saying of the cost for the nursing home, these are the amounts that are eligible for the medical expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use that number and it can go into her Schedule A for the medical expenses. And everything else would be the same as what you would file for yourself, the same, you know, if she has interest income or dividend income and whatever other medical costs that weren't covered by insurance.
Being that she's incapacitated, then obviously she can't take a dependent or she can't be a dependent. I asked her accountant for that kind of a booklet for this kind of thing, and he just gave me the same one they had the previous year, which just showed gathering of her, you know, stock dividends and so forth, and that didn't seem to apply to what her situation is now, other than she'll have a lot more outgo than income, is what he said. You know, shouldn't have to worry about putting any quarterly payments in because of the high cost of the is that 100% deductible, that nursing home?
It's subject to that 7.5%, only the amounts that are over 7.5% of her adjusted gross income can be deducted as a medical expense, but you can put all the medical expenses, the nursing home, the health insurance, the unreimbursed medical costs that she has to pay, you know, a copay or drugs, all of that can be included as an itemized deduction.
And you might, this year you might want to, since this kind of sounds like the first year you've been doing this, under these circumstances, you might want to just go to a preparer and sit down with a preparer and let him or her, you know, kind of go over things with you. I don't know. It's probably what I'd do if it was me.
Pick one in this state. It was in the state that she was in, and he just didn't handle it. And I'm sure there's going to be a place to deduct all the attorney fees, too, on some schedule or another.
Well, attorney fees are only deductible if they are if they were spent on income earning issues or tax planning issues. Just because they're legal fees themselves don't make them deductible.
Okay, I'll try again. Okay.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Barb, appreciate your call. Larry in Dubuque, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Larry and guests. 2008, I bought some stocks, and just last year, I sold off half of them and purchased another type of stock, and now my preparer is telling me that is going to be counted as income. And also the dividends that I receive and roll it back into the stock is going to be counted as income. Is that correct?
Yes, your preparer is correct. You sold stocks, and sounds like you had a gain on those. And those are reported as capital gain income, which has a more favorable tax rate. The dividends that were reported each year that were put back into the stock, to buy more stock, if that's what you were saying, that gets counted as basis. So if you paid $100 for the stock and every year for 10 years you had another dollar of dividends you put into it, then now your cost is $110. And that has to be reported. New this year, there's a new form for capital gains. We used to put it on a Schedule D. Now there's a brand new form. It's called the 8949, and because the you're required to report the basis, the purchase information, and the selling information, and the broker investment houses are supposed to provide you with that information.
Right. Yes.
And then it'll flow through to the Schedule D, which is where we used to put that information, but now it gets reported directly on the 8949.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Bob in River Falls. Hello to you.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I'm a divorced father of two, and it happened in 2005, and I have in our court document that I'm allowed to claim one of my girls. And I had up till last year, and turned out that my ex claimed my daughter, said that the law changed. And I do my taxes like file electronic service, and I submitted the proper documents, and I ended up getting a refund check in the mail, thinking, well, I must have been in the right, things were good. Well, I got a letter a month or so ago that said I better make sure that I have the right to claim my daughter. And I guess my main question is, has something changed where I would no longer have the right to claim her?
Well, the right to claim in a divorce parents or goes to the custodial parent, and if there's an agreement on their legal divorce agreement that says that even though custody is going to be with mom, but dad gets to claim them, sometimes it's every other year or some sharing, that is fine. But there's supposed to be a form that's filled out, which is form 8332, and
right.
That form is releasing the exemption to the non-custodial parent. And even though there may have been a divorce decree that specifies that, the IRS is no longer letting that rule. They want the form 8332 filled out, signed by the non-custodial parent, and it can be either an ongoing one or it can be just for that year. You can elect that on the form.
And I did have that signed every year up till last year. She refused to sign, and then I submitted copies of my divorce. There was another a list of steps to go through, which I did, mm-hmm. and that's for the IRS booklet, whatever, and I did that.
Well, if it was part of the legal arrangement you had, then it could be that you need to talk to your attorney, because if the agreement was that she was supposed to sign release the exemption for you, then you may have to seek legal remedy to get that to happen. The IRS is saying, we need the form.
Yeah. Okay. So without the form, I'm out of luck.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
There you go. So you need to probably talk to your attorney if you want to follow through on it.
Or get your return filed before she gets hers filed. Because the rejection electronically is whether there's already that dependent claimed in the system.
Hmm. There you go. David in Verona. Hello to you.
Thank you, sir. I have a full question. I'll try to be very quick. The first one is, this is all about fairly low income earners. We have a lot of 20-something kids who are starting out a pretty low income. There's an ABC to this. If my 27-year-old son making in the mid-20s files an easy form or the short form, but has A, student loan, federal student loan interest, B, moving expenses up, and C, wants to do a little IRA, aren't there now provisions for low-income earners who even do a short form 1040 to get, without itemizing, to get some kind of deduction or credit on any one or two of these three items?
A taxpayer filing a 1040A, there is a space to deduct student interest. That has nothing to do with itemized deductions. And they are eligible for the standard deduction, the annual standard deduction for a single person is for this year is $5,800. And I can't recall what the third part of that question was.
So he could find a place, even if he has the 1040A, the short
yes.
form, do a
yes.
federal student loan, how much he paid in interest. The
yes.
second part was moving expenses for a job, even with a short, with a 1040A, does that work, or do you have to do the long form of the whole list of itemized deductions?
It's not itemized deductions, but moving costs. Moving costs are, he had to have moved for the job, from, and it has to have been
50 miles.
Yeah, and then if they were unreimbursed, the
yep.
moving costs, but
yep.
but there's so those expenses can be taken, but then you do have to file a 1040 because the form mm-hmm. for that, the
and
number escapes
the,
me. What?
And doesn't the IRA, isn't there something now for, you know, IRA for, you know, a young person to put in a couple $300 without doing itemizing to do an IRA or no?
An IRA deduction has nothing to do with the itemizing. So,
oh, sure, that's right, of course.
So yes, there's nothing about the long form isn't just for itemizing. You can still
right.
take the standard deduction on a long form. There's other issues that make it necessary to file the 1040.
Sure, and the last part is the earned income credit. Where does one find the income? So if you're single, no kids, 27 years old, you make $21,000, wouldn't you be probably set for some kind of small earned income credit? Where do you find that scale, that chart? That
in the instructions to on the instruction booklet for the, you go on the IRS for the 1040, has the earned income credit calculations, but it is difficult to get the earned income credit if you're single and have no kids.
Yeah, pretty tough.
Yes.
There you go. Thank you, David, for calling. And Jamie in Wausau, pleased to have you join us. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I just have gotten the opportunity to take part in a flex dependent care plan. And I've always just claimed that at the end of the year on my taxes. And I'm wondering if there's any advantage to, besides getting your money back sooner, is there any advantage to taking it to the flex plan versus just claiming at the end of the year on my taxes for the dependent care?
The dependent care through your employer
yeah.
Is a essentially a reduction of your taxable income. So the answer is going to be it depends on what your tax rate is, because the tax credit is a dollar-for-dollar limit against your taxes, but it's, if I don't know how many kids you have, but it, at a certain limit, it's 20% is of the expense is the credit, whereas with the dependent care allowance in the flex plan, you're not paying Social Security taxes on this money. You're not paying income taxes on the money. You've just agreed to essentially lower your salary, your compensation, and instead get it paid out in dependent care. So the higher income you are, the usually the better these flex plan it's more to your advantage to go with the flex plan.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Mary Lou in Monroe. Hello to you.
Yes, good morning. Another child question. We just adopted a child in 2011. And when we adopted her and the plethora of paperwork that we got, they were talking about a adoption credit that we can get in our taxes. And I just got something in the mail the other day from our accountant who says they've lowered the adoption credit. And I guess my second question is that true? Is that going to apply to me? So now are we subject to the lower adoption credit? And the second part of the question is we are self-employed with negligible income from self-employment and small income from another part-time job. Is this child care credit, do you have to make a certain amount of money to get it? Is it actually a credit, or is it just a deduction on your taxes?
The child care credit or the child...
Child adoption, I'm sorry, child adoption credit.
Well, the adoption credit is for special needs children.
Mm-hmm.
So if your child qualifies...
Which she does.
Mm-hmm. Then you are eligible for the adoption credit, and it's considered a refundable credit, meaning that even if you don't have an income tax liability, you still get paid that credit. So it doesn't just take your income tax liability to zero. It can take it down to, oh, we owe you. So there is a credit for adoption of special needs children.
Okay. Now, is that a lowered amount this year? So the amount that was told to us a year or so ago, is that going to be different then?
The credit, the maximum is $13,360. So I don't know what was...
What you were told before.
I was told the $13,000, and then now I see something that just came that says it's lowered to $6,400.
I am not...
not seeing that.
I don't know.
Yeah. That'll require a little more research, I'm afraid. You're probably going to have to look into this.
I would be glad to... get back to you.
Yeah, if you want to post, you can even post on our Facebook page.
Sure.
Okay.
Why don't we do that? So just check the page, Mary Lou.
Okay.
Great.
All right. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Matt in Madison up next. Hi, Matt.
I got a question about, I'm self-employed, I collect sales tax, and my question is, there's a form, the ST-12 or whatever that I file every month. There's a spot for use tax, and I've had arguments back and forth with some other people in the same business, and so the situation I have is I buy my materials out of state from it's an Amish setup in Ohio, and the tools, the materials that I use, I then charge sales tax to the client, but with the tools that I buy that I just use in performing my job, is that the income that's subject to use tax, or is that the expense that's subject to use tax, or
when
does
you
make it?
Are you saying when you buy the tools?
Yes, when I buy the tools that are
you
just
need
for
to
my,
pay sales tax on those. And if you buy them from out of state and no sales tax was charged,
right,
then you're eligible, then you are supposed to pay use tax on them.
Okay, and that is the use tax. Okay,
yes.
Perfect. All right, that was what I wanted to know.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Victoria. If I used health spending account pre-tax dollars to pay medical expenses that exceed 7.5% of my income, do those expenses qualify as a deduction even though they were paid with pre-tax dollars?
The answer is no. That would be like double dipping. So,
I'm not going to get away with that one, Victoria.
No.
All right. My husband and his siblings, this is Lynn, received a, I think it's, it says pastor, but I think it means portion of their father's veterans insurance, apparently died, and the insurance was $32,000 for each child. Is that taxable?
If it's strictly life insurance proceeds, it's not it's not subject to income tax.
Which is a very nice thing.
Was some sort of annuity or IRA, then it is subject to income tax when they take it out. But if it's strictly life insurance, no.
My son, Valinda says, my son moved into the residential rental property and pays the mortgage, taxes, and insurance. The loan is in my name only. His tax people told him he can deduct the interest from the loan as long as I don't take the deduction. Is this correct?
Not really. the law states that you can take the deduction for when you... Even for expenses that you pay that you are liable for. So if I paid Larry's mortgage interest, because he has two, I could not deduct it because I'm not liable for that. It's not really my expense. And he can't deduct it because he didn't pay it. So if you're not selling the home to him, if it's not a land contract or whatever, then he's paying you rent in the form of paying the property taxes and the mortgage interest, and then you have to record that as income, and you can deduct the mortgage interest.
Ah, that's how it works. Well, here's something from our news guy, Michael Leland, who said, and this goes to Patriots Day, which is that the reason we're, as you explained, Dale, the reason we're having tax day on the April 17th instead of April 15th is because the 15th falls on Sunday, and then the Monday is Patriots Day, which is a holiday. Michael says it's a holiday in Massachusetts and Maine. It's the third Monday in April, and it commemorates the start of the Revolutionary War.
Yes, there is a Patriots Day, but there last year there was, I just don't remember the name, there was a different holiday that was strictly
fell the same way.
District
of Columbia.
Yes, and it wasn't, that's why when I said I think it's Patriots Day, but it could be the other, because Patriots Day is a Massachusetts holiday, and so on years when that has fallen on tax day, the federal government decided to give everybody that holiday. But I'll have to look up. I just can't remember what the holiday was last year. The D.C. holiday. It was a holiday specifically in the District of Columbia. Have been something about, I just don't remember.
Well, I tell you what, we'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Dale, for being with us today.
Busy.
And thanks to Michael. He's on vacation. What's he doing calling me? And thank you for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.